Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to All Exit Club. My guest today is my friend Steve Greenfield, and we're going to talk, as we have in the past, about student loan debt and the problem of adjunct professors, but we're going to talk about resistance and agitation. So, Steve, how are you this morning?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. So, with all of the pervasive problems related to higher ed at the universities, I'm surprised there's no outcry in the streets. People aren't shaking their fists and complaining and agitating for change. What do you think that is?
Well, you know, for starters, bear in mind we're having this conversation as people who were, you know, alive and watching political action during the, you know, the 1950s, the 1960s, you know, which was kind of like the pinnacle of the 20th century movement building and political successes of those movements. And we had different circumstances back in our youth, and as did all of the groups that were organizing, in terms of the way that our lives were structured. The biggest change, and the one I think is the biggest obstacle to movement formation today, is the internet, social media. We didn't have that much to do when we were younger in terms of sitting around inside our houses. You know, we did have television, but unless you were living in New York City, you didn't really have that many channels. You know, only the major population centers had numerous channels. You know, a typical medium-sized town in the United States might have had, you know, three channels, four channels, mm-hmm. and a small town, you know, one or two. So we filled our time, you know, with things. We didn't have social media. We socialized, you know, until the internet came on. If people wanted to socialize, they were in a bowling league. They were in a softball team. They were, you know, they were in a library book club. They were in the Kiwanis Club or the Elks Club, or, you know, and they had picnics and activities. And people were accustomed to the idea of being in each other's presence, sharing each other's, you know, smiles and activities and support for each other. There were, of course, labor unions, which also held meetings and picnics and softball leagues, summer camps associated with various kinds of institutions where people sent their kids so that their kids could be brought up in the habits of being social with people of shared values and shared backgrounds. And now, when we want to do that, we form a Facebook group and get people to join it. And they sit in their living rooms or their dining rooms or on their phones and whatever else it is that they're doing, or they click a person to follow on Twitter whose articles they like to read. And nobody's ever actually doing anything. They don't even have the ability to recognize the difference between how we relate to each other in online conversations in which we're not in each other's presence, and what it feels like to, you know, be together at a table, having a meal, cleaning up after the meal, putting the chairs together after the end of putting the chairs away after the meeting, you know, and folding up the tables and putting them back where they can't, you know. We do not, and the reason that they don't know how those two things are functionally different and spiritually different and relationally different is because they've never done the physical face-to-face meeting. They don't know that it's different. They don't know the ways that they're not actually functioning in an organizational manner. They really think that if they put a hashtag in front of a word and then get on Twitter tomorrow and find out that hashtag is trending because you know, 10,000 people have used the same hashtag on their own tweets, they feel like they're forcing Donald Trump out of office. They don't even realize that, like, they haven't done anything. They're just tracking how often a word was tracked on social media, and nobody's done a thing. So there's the, you know, the framework right there. If you're, you know, entering college now, you're 18 years old. If you have, if you're even, you know, in your early 30s and still paying off your college loan, you have never lived a day of your life in an age of actual social activity, of, you know, of organizational activity. You have never witnessed the political success of a movement, right? You have never witnessed 10 years of aggressive civil rights demonstrations, lunch counter sit-ins, mass arrests, bus boycotts, and everything else that went into, you know, voter registration drives and everything else that went into the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act finally being passed. You have no recognition that those two bills were actually voted for in higher percentages by Republicans than by Democrats. You know, you don't have no awareness of the history of how social progress has happened. You have no, you've never seen a strike. You've never seen union workers out on strike. You've never seen people trying to block scabs from entering a workplace. You have never witnessed any of these things. Every now and then you may see like five people on a street corner with that big inflatable rat while you're driving by, and you have no idea what's going on. Maybe some of you are nice enough to beep your horn at them and wave. But did any of you get, you know, did any of you get out of your car, join the picket line, talk to the strikers about why they're on strike, what their issues are, how long the collective bargaining process has been stalled? You know, what are their demands? We don't do that. You know, it's gone. And so labor unions are down to about 10% of the population that they had, you know, 50 years ago. You know, there are no movements. There are no social pressures, you know, no civil disobedience, nothing. And what needs to happen is that we need to actually revive physical community among people that have shared issues. We have to get together. We have to eat dinner together. We have to fold up the chairs when we're done. We have to strategize ways to, you know, create actions and obstructions of the daily routine so that the issue that we're being talked about merits getting people's attention. You know, if you don't change the course of a person's day, they're not going to pay attention to you. If you're blockading a street, they're going to pay attention to you, even if they're angry, even if the reason is because they're angry, because they can't drive, they can't get where they're going, right? Whatever it is, I mean, how do you make what you're doing worthy of people's attention? When you open up a Facebook page and ask people to click like on your page, you're not drawing attention to your issue to anybody except people that already, you know, have some awareness and some concern about your issue. And then you're only asking of them, you know, the minimal buy-in to what you're trying to do. You're not asking them to change their daily routine. In fact, you're asking them to reinforce their daily routine, because that's what we do every day. We see Facebook pages we like and we click like on them, you know, and then we move on. Then we move on and do something else, read some other article, send somebody else a tweet. And so there is a complete absence of awareness in 2019 of what a movement is, and let alone how they should function. And so, you know, on the other side of that coin, however, there are forces of right-wing reaction in this country that have been wildly successful over the last 30 years. And the reason for that is because many of them still participate in traditional face-to-face community, the biggest one, of course, being, you know, your right-wing evangelical churches, right? They get together every Sunday, you know, they get together and they get a lecture, right? They listen to a sermon. They eat lunch together and they clean up. They send their children to evangelical Christian summer camps because they don't want them coming under secular or scientific influence. And they want them to feel like they're living together and they're all family, so that they all feel loyal to each other. You know, so there are traditional movements still in ample existence in this country. The problem is that they're all right-wing movements. And, you know, the secondary problem, of course, is that they're all succeeding. And so, you know, that's really the problem. You know, progressives have become comfortable. Progressives want to read and share information with each other. Here's a great article I read. You'll love this. Not, here's a meeting I'm holding, and I want you to come to it. And when you come to it, I'm going to give you a homework assignment, you know, and we're going to be developing a strategy of obstructive action that's going to force people into consciousness. You know, Horton Hears a Who by Dr. Seuss, right? Horton finds that there's this, you know, a whole planet of tiny people living inside a flower. And what does he do? He gets that, you know, they all start chanting, we are here, we are here, until their chanting has become so loud that the people in the larger world around them recognize, you know, that they're there. They can hear them and then start mm-hmm. paying attention to their plight, to the potential for their destruction and how to protect them. We always used to know this. The whole history of the world is about this. You know, we learn about, you know, Gandhi in school, and we learn about King, and we learn about the labor movement. But we don't, you know, register with that, you know, anything about how they accomplished what they accomplished. We only sort of take a cursory academic view of what the changes were, you know, and we've completely lost touch with how the changes were brought about. And so now we don't know how to bring change about anymore.
Okay, now I see the problem that you and I talk about once a week, and the problem with other people is I see a multifaceted problem. There's the university system with their professors who are paid very poorly. The working conditions are bad, and they have no job security, no pensions, no health insurance. And then there's the students who will be burdened by student debt once they leave college. So we're talking about two distinct classes of people or groups of people. And you would think that they would say, oh, my God, this is a problem. I can't live like this anymore. But yet they do nothing about it. What do you say about that?
You know, I say that it's the thing that we've been talking about up until just now, which is that they wish they could do something, but they actually can't conceive of what they could do. You know, it's not that they don't want to do something. It's kind of like, let's say I wanted to go to the moon. You know,
mm-hmm.
and I was well aware that, you know, I can't jump that high, and I do have a powerful vehicle, my car, but it can't
right.
escape gravity. And so, well, I guess
right.
going to the moon is just not possible. I'm not going to do it. Whereas somebody else will sit around. I'm thinking of this because I just watched that amazing Apollo 11 documentary. You know, somebody else will sit around and say, well, what if this wasn't the only kind of vehicle we could have? What if there's potentially a kind of vehicle that nobody's aware of yet because nobody has, you know, sat down and tried to conceive of what it would look like and what kind of fuel it would need? And let's go work on that. And, you know, and then if we can't come up with anything, fine, we'll give up on our dream of going to the moon. But if, you know, but if we can actually conceive of a means by which to design and engineer a way out of Earth's atmosphere and gravitational pull, then we'll continue to proceed and continue developing that. And so that's really what, you know, an analogy to what's happening to people. These people, adjuncts want their pay raised and their job security, you know, created. The people that are under the burden of student debt want their debt relieved. People that are first getting ready to go to college now definitely want public universities to be restored to a tuition-free status they all had before the 1970s. We certainly have, you know, we have triple the GDP today per capita, so certainly we have the resources. It's not for lack of resources. But what's happened over time is that people have lost track of the means by which change happens, and so They conceive of change, but they don't act on it. And it's not because of lack of will or lack of interest, but literally because of sensing, you know, that there's nothing that can be done. But in many ways, we have a greater ability to do things today than we ever did during the heyday of successful social movements, because believe it or not, a lot of people have the kind of security, financial security, that people engaged in risk-taking in movements didn't used to have. We now have many, many millions of people who are on Social Security and don't have to worry that their boss will fire them if they're late to work tomorrow, because they're not going to work tomorrow, and they don't depend on going to work to pay their rent and feed themselves. They're on pensions. We also, believe it or not, as depressing as this sounds, we have many, many millions of people whose incomes come from social services or from unemployment. They, too, do not have to go to work tomorrow to be sure that their income is going to come in. They don't, you know, so, you know, we actually have a greater ability now to engage in social movements and in social movements that involve risk-taking in order to get attention from the public and from the media. And what's missing really is people, being rallied around awareness of their heightened ability that they have today. You know, those people that we used to see back in the days when the evangelical churches were operating this thing they called Operation Rescue, where they would target abortion clinics, and if they had police barricades in front of them, they would crawl around on their knees and get underneath them. Those people were all paid. You know, the Christian movement would rent a house across the street from the abortion clinic, and six or seven of their people would go live there indefinitely and have their food and rent provided to them so that they could get up every morning and crawl under those barricades. You know, the situation with Social Security and pensions and social services and unemployment insurance essentially provides that kind of sustenance to people who have the most at stake in social change. And all that's really missing is some kind of galvanizing message for them to get out there and put those, you know, revenue streams to productive use, you know, in their security, like I said, not having to lose their jobs, you know, if they're late for work or if they're seen on television protesting or if they got arrested. You know, so the point is to just get that message out there, right, that there not only are effective things that can be done and proven strategies by which they're done, by which these movements conduct themselves effectively, but that we don't even have many of the fears and concerns that would inhibit people's ability to enter into these movements. You know, a lot of that's been solved by the success of earlier social action.
So the powers that be, I want to use that phrase, whether it be a elected official, politician, university administrator, do they understand that social movements and agitating for change is not going to be as it used to? Therefore, they could get away with anything they want to.
Well, for starters, that's the sense they have now, but there's no reason that that has to remain the case. You know, one of the things that we all witnessed a couple of years ago in the movements in other countries that we called the Arab Spring is that they were actually using their phones and their social media to enhance the impact of actual physical movements, to communicate with each other, not in their living rooms like we do, but out in the street. I saw this myself, something in a very similar manner myself, back in 2004. On August 31st, 2004, I joined in with the War Resisters League in coordination with many, many other groups that designed a traditional public action and an obstruction action outside the Republican National Convention. We marched from the former World Trade Center site up towards Madison Square Garden, and there were a number of street blockades that I participated in one of them and got arrested, along with a few thousand other people who got arrested that day. And one of the things that was happening while we were on the course of our march was that there were streets being closed off by the police. You know, we were doing a legal march. We were marching on sidewalks, and there's no law that can prevent you from doing that. And yet there were some streets along the path that the police were starting to close off with barricades so as to entrap people inside those streets and then put them on buses, you know, in handcuffs and take them to the detention center. And during the course of the parade, there were scouts up front who were using their cell phones to tell us which streets people, the cops were blocking off so that we could adjust our parade route and go on different streets that weren't blockaded so that we all eventually got to our destination. So that's an example that was done here. Obviously, that was already, we're coming up on 15 years since that happened. But that's what was done in the Arab Spring, right? People were using their cell phones on the scenes to provide all kinds of logistical information to the people that were in the streets. And so there's no reason why our cell phones and our social media have to keep us indoors in our own living rooms. They can be used as, you know, tactically. But the like I said, what is missing is that nobody right now is specifically galvanizing people who are interested in various kinds of social change to return to traditional organizing. Even in terms of civil disobedience, you are not going to be able to form an affinity group like your little four-person or five-person component of the larger Civil Disobedience Act, which is made up of people you know and trust so that you know you're not infiltrated or that your strategy is going to be diverted on the scene by somebody you don't know calling things out. Well, you can't form an affinity group if you don't, you know people, if you're not having face-to-face meetings with people, dinner with people, you know, having picnics with people, and you don't really know if those are people that feel like family to you and have that level of trust and loyalty. So we really need to get back to traditional, you know, face-to-face group gatherings, you know, work being done. You know, it's just the kind of thing, even a simple thing, for example, like let's say a student loan movement in a local area agreed to pick up a 2-mile stretch of an Adopt-a-Highway program. Then they wouldn't even have to put up any money, and the Adopt-a-Highway program would put up a big sign on their 2-mile stretch that says, you know, this stretch of Route 299, Adopt-a-Highway for the Student Debt Relief Organization of New Paltz, New York. And then, you know, just once a year in the spring, you would go out there and put on orange vests and gloves, and you would pick up cigarette butts off the side of the road, throw them in bags, and people would see that the, you know, that the New Paltz Student Loan Debt Relief Organization is out there. And the other 364 days of the year, everybody would be driving by a sign that says there's an organization called the New Paltz, you know, debt relief or whatever, you know, whatever you do with it. We don't do that, and we're not going to start doing it until a number of people get together to agree that the messaging has to be sent out, a strong, powerful, galvanizing message has to be sent out that traditional organizing is necessary and the way to go, and that we're going to, you know, completely cease using our social media for any purpose other than to remind each other of what date and time we're having our meetings. You know, we've got to somehow get that word out.
Okay.
Go ahead, sorry.
Let me bring up two things. Back in the early 70s, when Nixon was president, there were massive anti-war movement demonstrations. And I remember reading Nixon looking out his window and seeing all those people. It really freaked him out. And that's when the war started winding down. But then in the early 2000s, leading up to the Iraq invasion, people were out in the streets, and there was millions of them, millions. And that didn't change a thing. Cheney and Bush still, you know, did what they wanted to do. So in the 70s, it worked. I think in the early 2000s, the massive demonstrations really didn't work. So what do you say about that?
Well, the reason that the demonstrations did not work is, and I went to them, you know, I mean, I went to that big march on Washington before the war started, and other, you know, other marches and events and gatherings in public parks here regionally, in Kingston, New York, and down in New York City that were very crowded. But the thing that was wrong with them, which we're seeing, you know, played out again, with the women's marches and things like that, is that they're one-off events. They're single events. If you don't go back out there tomorrow, nobody has to be worried about you. And not only that, you're actually helping them, because they can then say, hey, see, here in the United States, we have freedom of assembly. Here in the United States, no matter how much we disagree with each other, we protect our rights to assemble. We protect our rights to free speech. And so you actually end up helping the people you're trying to stop. When the Montgomery bus boycott was underway, that went on day after day after day after day after day after day after day. Nobody got on the buses ever. They didn't just have a one-day bus boycott as symbolism to say we're angry about having to sit in the back of the buses, and then the next day they just got on the bus and went back to the back of the bus again. No, they boycotted the buses every single day. In the anti-Vietnam War movement, those people were out there every single day, and they weren't just standing there holding signs. They were blocking, you know, ROTC offices on college campuses, blockading them and getting arrested. They were interfering with shipments of armaments out of factories. They were, you know, making it impossible for people to go to work because they had streets blockaded. They went out there every single day. Nixon didn't start winding down the war because he looked out his window one day across at the Ellipse and saw 20,000 people there. And then he woke up the next day and they were gone. You know, he felt these concerns, and they weren't even, you know, just a narrow concern about, you know, what was he going to see when he looked out his window. He was concerned about, you know, social chaos that was potentially being caused by the persistence of these movements, right? Things like jails being overwhelmed and not being able to contain all the people that they needed to arrest. And what's your backup plan under that? What is happening if people are refusing to participate in the economy, if they're boycotting major corporations, and, you know, and so those corporations are going to lose demand and fire workers and the economy is going to contract? Like, there was actual impact to those movements. It wasn't just that he was looking out the window and seeing people and he wanted that to stop. You know, that's just the more superficial way of looking at it. The movements were actually potent movements. Him seeing them out the window was just a reminder to him every day, you know, that the movements were potent movements and that something needed to be done to get them to stop. You know, so, you know, he was practical. It wasn't like, the United States is purpose and profits and everything were being significantly advanced at that point by the Vietnam War, because it was bogged down and a traditional military victory was not one of the options available. And it's the same kind of thing today, right? What are we doing in Iraq? What are we doing in, look what just in Libya right now? Libya is, American forces were just removed from Libya. Thank you, you know, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton for setting that one up. Because right now, at this moment, Libya is exploding into civil war and a rebel militia is invading Tripoli. You know, we're not stakeholders in this. You know, if we had actual movements that were creating social and economic pressure inside the United States, you know, Trump would be pulling everybody out of everywhere all over the world where we're fighting. But we don't have an anti-war movement anymore. And a few thousand people standing in front of the White House with signs and then going home and not coming back out again tomorrow is not going to change that. It's going to be a, you know, that's what happened with Iraq. I was even saying people at the time, you know, if we're not doing this again tomorrow, then it's just a First Amendment celebration. It's not a movement, and it's not even specifically really against the war, but more of an identity thing, like, hey, we're all the people that are against the war, and then we just go home. Like, we don't continue mm-hmm. having any further presence or applying any further pressure in terms of getting the war to stop. You know, I personally, you know, by a couple of years into the Iraq war, I stopped going to the annual marches. I told people that I would personally no longer be participating in First Amendment celebrations, you know, but that if anybody actually wanted to do anything, they could feel free to make me the first person they call. And I still feel that way to this day. You know, so we need to, in terms of the student debt crisis, you know, that we're having, and you and I have spoken about this in previous podcasts, we have to start moving the conversation, getting together a small number of people who will take some form of coordinated direct action. You know, as we were discussing earlier, in every single congressional district, that makes it impossible for the media not to realize that.
Steve, our half hour is up. So can we continue this conversation next week and create a blueprint for people all over the country to take direct action to do all the things that need to be done?
Yes, we can, but I'm not going to be home. We're away all of next week. Maybe we can do it on Friday morning.
Okay, that would be fine. Would be fine. So you have been listening to All Exits Closed and with my friend Steve Greenfield, who is a social activist and a Green Party member. So if you like the show, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And please be sure to tell all your friends about, you know, All Exits Closed. We have a website, and the more people talking about it, the better off we will all be. So, Steve, we'll talk soon. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you.